In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This episode contains material that may be disturbing to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
Cold cases that doesn't get solved are very rare in Finland. Our clearance rate of homicides are nearly 100%. It is one of the highest in the whole world.
On a December evening in 1987, a young mother of two was discovered brutally murdered at her workplace. A potential suspect came forward, confessing to the crime. However, investigators lacked the technical evidence to corroborate his confession. The case gradually goes cold, but decades later, police decide to interrogate the man again.
When you're talking about homicides and serious crimes, the interrogations are almost spirit world experience and mental struggle between the investigator and the suspect.
Who is this man? And does the investigators now have something more on him that ties him to the crime?
It's a strange playfield where you're living. And if the police have evidence, they might not want to tell that immediately. So it takes a lot of tactics.
This case will bring challenges for the prosecution. And the man's sentencing revisits an age-old philosophical debate.
Can we punish a person for the crimes he may be? Will do in the future.
You're listening to Nordic Crimes. Murder Gone Cold. In early December 1987, the festive spirit of Christmas permeated the air. Magazines shimmered with pages of festive gift suggestions and photos of jubilant families in matching bathrobes. This holiday atmosphere wasn't solely confined to print. The capital itself was beautifully immersed in the essence of the season. This festive ambience was the backdrop to a society that had been evolving over the past decade. Since the introduction of the nursery law in 1973, mothers with young children found a new encouragement to re-enter the workforce. This legislation, pivotal in its time, allowed women the independence to divorce without the crippling worries of financial constraints. Freed from an over-reliance on their spouse's earnings, they could rise as self-sufficient single parents. In 1984, the momentum of change continued. A new law emerged, ensuring the right to co-parent. This was a significant shift, asserting that women were not just destined to be caregivers. It carved up more freedom for them to chase after their professional aspirations, leading to a steady increase in the female workforce year after year. It was against this societal canvas that Raija Mukkonen's story unfolds. On the 9th of December, Raija, a 41-year-old single mother of two teens, ventured back to her workplace after a short break. Earlier in the day, she had accompanied a colleague to the train station and made a brief stop at her residence to check on her children. Raija, serving as the financial manager of a stone refinery, was known for her unwavering dedication, often working long hours into the night. Yet, the day after Raya's recent overtime shift, a somber mood cast a shadow over the season's joy. Outside the office, fresh snow covered the ground, but inside, a chilling scene awaited Raya's colleagues. A broken window, evidence of a brawl, and blood smears culminated in the heartbreaking discovery of Raya's lifeless form. A prominent crime journalist of the period, who also happened to be named Raija, Raija Pelli, recalls the dire circumstances surrounding Raija Mukkonen's untimely demise with clarity.
When I saw the authentic pictures from the crime scene, it was awful. It was truly horrible.
Raija Pelli began her journey in crime and legal journalism in the 1980s. As the decade drew to a close, she, alongside her colleagues, pitched to their superiors the idea of a TV crime program. One that merged journalistic integrity with a resistance to sensationalism, all while collaborating with counterparts in other Nordic nations.
We started to open cases outside the Finnish borders. We cooperated with Swedish Efterlyst that grounded their program on our format. We were the first program in the Nordic countries to do series like this.
Even after a staggering 36 years since Raija Mukkonen's murder, the vivid details are etched in Raija Pelli's memory. The crime scene's sheer brutality made it hard to forget. Upon their arrival, local police immediately recognized the magnitude of the crime and summoned the National Bureau of Investigation. Swiftly isolating the scene, investigators began questioning Raija's colleagues. Fresh footprints in the snow hinted that a lone individual was responsible. The stone refinery had its offices gracing the facade, while the actual refinery hall sat deeper within. Evidence indicated Raija's harrowing final moments, dragged through various sections of the building, from office to lobby to basement, and finally to the stone refinery hall where her body was left atop a stone boulder. Her injuries were appalling. A brutal blow to the head using a 5-kilo rail wheel, strangulation with a monitor cord, and multiple stabbings around her eyes. The excessive violence begged the question, why move the body throughout the building but leave it on site? When officials made contact with Raija's children at school, her elder daughter bravely took charge of her younger brother, a first-year high school student.
It was horrible. First of all, they were the primary victims because they were the children of the deceased person. You can imagine the pain they felt to lose their mother like this, so sudden and surprising, and because of this kind of deed. It's different to lose a beloved person from a car accident, but to lose someone so close to you because of another person's doing, those people have been in a really bad situation. Of course, as journalists, we would never have approached them that, oh, how are you feeling now? That would have been such an idiotic behavior. Absolutely not. You don't do that. In this kind of case and situation, you have to leave the victims alone. You have to give them peace and respect. At least that's how our program worked. We never took that approach that we should somehow benefit from the victim's pain and suffering. We would have only added to it if we tried to interview them in that situation.
Kärsimystä, tuskaa. Mutta sitten vaan lisätty sitä.
My name is Matti Laine. I am a retired principal lecturer. I have lectured in several educational institutions in Finland, and I have specialized especially in criminology and sociology of punishment. Typical homicides were those done in a group of alcohol-drinking men. Both the perpetrators and the victims were usually marginalized people having social problems and very often prison or community sanctions background. We can even say that sometimes it was coincidence who was killing who. In 1980s, it happened usually these homicides during weekend in a private apartment. They were done with Finnish puukko or kitchen knife. Most of them were manslaughters, not murders. The homicides per capita in a year in Finland was the highest one in a whole Western Europe, 3 times higher than, for example, in Sweden and Great Britain in 1980s. In that sense, we were an Eastern European country. And we can say that in generally our criminality was criminality for rural society at that time.
Commonly, victims and perpetrators are acquainted. This had the investigators speculating. Was the murderer someone from Raya's personal circle? Was it a crime of passion or an incidental encounter with a thief? The evidence. A shattered window, cash missing from the safe, and Raya's stolen wallet suggested a burglary turned tragically violent. Subsequent interviews with Raya's acquaintances revealed she was held in high regard, with no discernible motive for anyone to wish her harm. Even her relationship with her children's father was harmonious. Forensic psychiatry's chief psychiatrist, Hannu Lauerma, states that in Finland, most violent acts are typically committed under the influence of substances, with perpetrators often acting on impulse, only to later grapple with the weight of their actions. Lauerma describes this as a flaming rage of shame, where individuals, harboring a low self-worth, shield their fragility with explosive outbursts. For Finnish culprits, this trait has historical underpinnings and, sadly, has been a recognized stereotype in neighboring nations for years.
Finland could also export this violence. For example, in 1960s, 1970s, hundreds of thousands of people moved to Sweden to work there. But of course, there moved young men who couldn't find always work. They have some alcohol problems, and that is why very soon it could be seen in Swedish prisons. For example, I heard that more than half of the prisoners serving life sentence have had some kind of background from Finland. For example, they were themselves come from Finland, or their parents or grandparents have a background in Finland. The Finnish men have this reputation for knife fighting and being violent. And I think it is true. In 1960s, especially made by a very cheap Sweden knife called Mora.
Raya's tragic end appeared to be a case of being at the wrong place at the wrong time, inadvertently stumbling upon a burglar in the act. The intruder seemingly gained entry through a window. Given the stone refinery's deafening machinery, neither Raya nor the burglar could hear each other. The intruder's initial intent seemed to be theft, but upon their unexpected encounter, violence ensued. Raya was assaulted with a rail wheel, coerced into unlocking the safe, and subsequently strangled with a computer cord. The burglar then moved her around the premises. The further brutality towards her eyes using a knife suggested a sporadic act, especially since all weapons were sourced on site. In cases like this, within the Finnish legal context, distinguishing between murder and manslaughter becomes crucial.
starting point is that in our criminal law, it basically the homicide is a manslaughter. But then there are four premises when it comes to a murder. First, there is a firm premeditation. Second, it is done by crude and cruel manner. Or third, the victim is a civil servant on duty, for example, police officer. And fourth, if the deed creates severe public danger. And generally, the crime must be aggravated as a whole. Those are the premises when homicide can be said that it's a murder. Of course, it's always that court will decide it.
The incident leaned more towards murder. Although investigators were tireless in their pursuit, they hit roadblocks, causing the inquiry to stall. Raja Pelli is particularly well-versed in the investigation's progression, as Raja Mukkonen's murder featured prominently on the first episode of Police TV.
No, se on tietenkin vaikea mun sanoa. Mä olin vaan se toinen.
It's hard for me to say exactly. I was just a journalist. Of course, we had a lot of information, but we couldn't put everything in the program. The police need the details in case they catch the perpetrator, and some criminals want to admit crimes they didn't do. And they take that information from the media and what's being said about the crime in there. And that will cause extra work for the police during their investigation. But at the beginning of the investigation, the lead detective got ill and he needed to stay at home for some time. Of course, in this kind of case, another officer precedes the investigation, but it's not always clear that the investigators have the same views or methods. The investigation was restarted. But of course, when the investigation didn't proceed at full speed from the beginning because of the sick leave, if the time passes, that unfortunately often means that the perpetrator wins. He can change his appearance, leave the country. Many things can happen, and the investigation becomes more and more difficult.
One unique aspect of the crime was the targeted violence towards the victim's eyes. Authorities pondered if this might be indicative of a ritualistic killing, potentially rooted in another culture. Raya's Asian colleague was questioned to discern if any such practices existed within his cultural background. However, this line of inquiry lacked substantial evidence, and he was released after interrogation. Evidence at the crime scene also pointed to possible substance abuse. Scattered fragments of glue sticks suggesting the perpetrator might have been inhaling glue fumes, a prevalent vice in the 1980s. Yet this lead hit a dead end. But there were many other clues. Witnesses reported a suspicious yellow car, initially identified as a Ford Escort but later corrected to an Opel Kadett, with two apprehensive-looking men. But this lead fizzled out. The car was stolen, and the occupants weren't connected to Raya's demise. Traces of footprints in the snow provided another potential lead. The shoes, however, were also stolen, leaving the police at another impasse. Despite rigorous checks on potential burglars and car thefts in the vicinity, the investigators were led into yet another dead end. Even with consistent public outreach, the case grew colder and colder.
Cold cases that doesn't get solved are very rare in Finland. Our clearance rate of homicides are nearly 100%. During last decade, it has been 98%. And it is one of the highest in the whole world. Usually the perpetrator is cleared at once. He or she is waiting there for police officers or medics to come. But yearly, there are few, maybe one or two cases, which will stay cold at least for some time. Often we speak about the person who has disappeared and there is a strong suspicion of possible homicide.
2 months after the murder, in February 1988, the police seemed no closer to identifying the culprit. Importantly, they had kept details about the violence inflicted on the victim's eyes from the public. Then, a concerned mother reached out to the local police.
She reported her 21-year-old son, a known offender, had recently threatened her, specifically mentioning an intent to pierce her eyes. The officer who took her call documented the information and alerted the investigation team. Intrigued, the detectives brought the young man in for questioning. Despite his age, he had an extensive criminal record, involving drugs, violence, and stints in juvenile hall and prison. However, he denied any involvement in the crime. While the police looked into his potential connection, the lead grew cold. This young man became just one of many suspects. The investigation goes nowhere. In 1989, Raya Pelli and her colleagues aired the first episode of their investigative crime journalism program, which eventually ran for 24 years and was well known to the Finnish public by Poliisi TV, Police TV.
Hyvää iltaa Poliisi TV:stä. Haimme tänään vihjeitä useista.
In the first episode, they discussed the cold case of Raya Mukkonen's murder.
Se oli surma, joka oli tapahtunut 2 vuotta aikaisemmin, vuonna 87.
It was a manslaughter that had happened 2 years earlier, in 1987, but had stayed cold. We had pretty good starting points because there were things we knew, like what had happened in the crime scene, what traces were there, and there are always people who have seen something. Because the place where Raya Mukkonen was killed was a very central location, so someone must have seen something. And the police had found eyewitnesses already at the early stages of the investigation, but not the perpetrator. So that became our main story. But of course, we also had to make clear for the audience how they need to act if they know something, have seen something, heard something, that how to call and inform the police. So we were still finding our final format for the program as well.
The main thing about the Police TV was to collect tips from the audience. They had a hotline where a witness could call and speak directly to the police. Throughout the years when Police TV was airing, the program helped the investigators solve several hundred cases with their hotline item.
Vihjefunktiohan oli se, mitä me odotettiin.
The hotline item was what we always waited for most, because there were serious crimes that needed witnesses in order to get solved. Sometimes we would get tips that matched the perpetrator so well that the police could issue an all-point bulletin, and when they found the perpetrator, they could tie him to that crime. There was a good number of these successful cases since the early years. Even one murder already at the beginning of the 90s was solved because of the tip we got from our episode.
Tässä Raya Mukkosen tapauksessa, toki mä muistan sen, mä kattelin näitä mun muistiinpanoja.
In the Raya Mukkonen case, of course I remember it, and I was looking at my notebook from that time. We did get tips, but not that kind of a tip that would clearly have opened something new that the detectives didn't already know. The tips confirmed the things the police knew, and that was a good thing as well. The detective has told me that it is beneficial to be able to rule out things as well. And always when there are eyes that have seen, ears that have heard, we did get those eyewitness tips about the possible perpetrator who had been standing outside the building. All of the witnesses described the person the same way, that this kind of person was there, looking at the window with the lights on. It did give me chills to think about how the witness might have been that close to the potential perpetrator.
But no matter the eyewitnesses, it didn't take the investigation further. The case goes cold. But in August 1991, a local police in Espoo gets a handwritten paper note saying, "Did the woman in Murala have glasses?" The note was written by Hannu Rissanen, a known criminal who'd recently been arrested for trying to kill his sister. After his most recent release from prison, he assaulted his sister, strangling her and stabbing her in the torso with a fork, all while threatening to gouge out her eyes. This wasn't a new threat. He is the same man whose mother had voiced concerns about over 3 years prior. In between these incidents, he also attacked his brother. Officers visited Hannu in the Espoo police jail for questioning. There, Hannu confessed. He detailed how he'd broken into the stone refinery, assaulted Raija Mukkonen, and then gouged her eyes out to prevent her from identifying him later on. He even questioned whether a person's final visual memory could be imprinted on the retina. He went on to say that after the murder, he'd stolen the cash box and left with a friend who acted as his getaway driver. However, a twist came a month later in September 1991. When the police spoke with Hannu again, he recanted everything. He said he concocted the story after reading about the case in a crime magazine. The note, he claimed, was just a sick joke. He mentioned the police had shared details about the case early in the investigation. No matter the new, very promising questioning with a potential suspect, the police decided not to proceed with it. The man had admitted killing Raija in questioning and denied everything in the interrogation.
I can't say what the letter brought to the investigators, but sometimes there are cases when a person wants to come forward to the police announcing themselves as the perpetrator, and it turns out that they are not relevant to this case. There might be mental health issues that make the person believe it's important to come forward.
In July of 1992, the same Espoo police received another handwritten note from Hannu. He hinted at a desire to continue their previous discussion. He was back in custody after failing to return from a prisoner's furlough. Over the following week, police interviewed Hannu around 5 times. His account was inconsistent. He described specifics about the night of Raija's murder, details he never repeated in subsequent interviews. Some of these sessions were recorded. The police even took Hannu to the crime scene. He pointed out the shattered window and gave details about the inside of the building, even noting certain alterations since the incident. He recounted striking Raija with a heavy object and dragging her body inside. He said things escalated when Raija tried to phone the police. "Who would want to get caught?" he remarked. Hannu spoke about gouging out Raija's eyes and his later attempt to do the same to his sister. The authorities sought to speak with Hannu's mother about her call 2 months post Raija's death, but she declined, citing family ties. As summer progressed, the investigation once again stalled. The evidence, police felt, was insufficient. To press charges, they need more concrete proof. Back then, tools at their disposal included fingerprinting, blood type analysis, an examination of fiber and shoe sole samples. DNA analysis wasn't available until a year later. A mere confession like, "I killed her," doesn't carry weight without linking the suspect to the scene. In this investigation, there were no fingerprints, unmatched shoe soles, or fiber samples. The blood found was solely Raija's. Thus, despite Hannu's vivid recounting of the crime, there was nothing solid connecting him to it.
Se on vähän ihmeellistä kyllä, mutta näin.
It is a little bit strange, but that's what happened. And it's not unheard of. These kind of things happen. And the more the crime had been poked around in those years, the information always leaked to the ears of the criminals. Criminals chat with each other, whether they are in prison or pre-trial detention. They do share information, and sometimes the information builds from jigsaw puzzles to a person who wants to come forward as the perpetrator. That's why the police always need to have the final clue, ace up in the sleeve, that helps to tie the person in the crime scene or prove that they were not there.
The investigators exhausted every lead. With the suspect retracting his confession, they felt they'd hit a dead end. Despite conducting over 100 interrogations, comparing 164 sets of fingerprints, examining 340 pieces of evidence, and checking over 100 vehicles, even interviewing almost every possible dog walker, they were left without a substantial lead. By August 1992, all the evidence was packed into large plastic containers and stored in the archives. The team was uncertain when or if these boxes would see the light of day again. Days become weeks. Weeks become months, and months become years. It's the beginning of 2004, and Finnish investigators have started re-examining what might be the most infamous cold murder case in the nation's history. On June 5th, in 1960, four teenagers camped beside Lake Bodom in Espoo. The following morning, three of them, two 15-year-old girls and an 18-year-old boy, were discovered brutally murdered in their sleep. Only one teenager, another 18-year-old boy, survived. As the Bodom murder case underwent fresh scrutiny, the police approached it as if the crime had just occurred. The goal was to revisit the evidence using contemporary technology. This fresh perspective sparked an idea. Could this method be applied to other unsolved cases? Detective Sergeant Niko Rantsi of the National Bureau of Investigation was present when the packed evidence from Raija Mukkonen's case, stored in large plastic boxes, was reopened and re-examined.
Mä olin just tullut KRP:n töihin, kun se otettiin tutkintaan.
I had just started working in the Criminal Bureau of Investigation when they started to reinvestigate the case.
Siinä voisi olla niin kuin aineksia uudelleen tutkittavaksi. Ja
the senior staff had a hunch that this case could be beneficial to reinvestigate. The investigation technology had improved. They must have thought whether they could investigate the samples in a laboratory and could that lead to a breakthrough because the DNA register existed at the time already.
Aika ajoin näitä otetaan tutkittavaksi näitä tämmöisiä niin sanottuja kylmiä murhia, jotka on viilenneet pahasti.
Obviously, there are other cold cases as well. Sometimes they are being reopened. I would gladly investigate more of them, but the work is really hard. An old case like this, with many boxes of material, it's not like you go through it for a couple of weeks and all of a sudden you have an epiphany. It usually takes months of orientation and adoption of the material.
Se yleensä vaatii niin kuin useiden jopa kuukausien perehtyneisyyden siihen aineistoon. Ja
because for the crime investigator who starts to investigate an old case, for them it's a new case. They haven't visited the crime scene and digesting the case is much lower versus when you get to investigate the case when it's all fresh.
Ja voi olla, että se kaikki työ, mitä sä teet monta kuukautta, niin se sitten nousee seinä vastaan kuitenkin.
And it might be that after investigating for months, you hit a wall after all. Of course, you can't think this beforehand. You have to believe in what you're doing. It's the same in anything you do in life. You can't throw a spear very far unless you believe it can fly.
In 2004, the investigators don't hit a wall. They are hit by a massive wave, a tsunami. On the 26th of December 2004, South Asia is struck with the largest natural disaster of massive earthquakes that caused tsunamis on the beaches from Malaysia all the way to the east coast of Africa. Tens of thousands of people die. Many of them are from Nordic countries.
I had personally been working on the case a little over 6 months when the tsunami happened. In my unit, there are a little less than 30 people. The tsunami investigation engaged almost all of us. This is because the victim identification unit is led by the National Bureau of Investigation. And the main team is assembled from my unit.
Se oli niin massiivinen se tsunamitutkinta.
The tsunami investigation was so massive that it took all of our time. I myself worked only on that for a year and a half. My job was to be in contact with the missing people's families. There was no possibility to work on anything else. It took up all our energy and time.
Se vei kaiken energiaa ja ajan silloin.
After the tsunami investigation, the officers are returning to Raya's case. It's been almost 20 years since Raya was murdered. The officers once again open the 7 plastic boxes and dust off the folders. Nico starts working as the assistant for the lead investigator. During the next months, they go through the material, and the head investigators start to get ready to interrogate the suspect, Hannu Rissanen. Regarding tactics of interrogation, the police work carefully.
When you're talking about homicides and serious crimes, the interrogations are almost spirit world experience and mental struggle between the investigator and the suspect. Because when you think about the suspect's situation, they might be facing life in prison, which in Finland is at least 12 years or in average 14 years in prison. So that struggle, whether the suspect confesses or doesn't, and what they will say, it's a strange playfield where you're living. And if the police have evidence, they might not want to tell that immediately. So it takes a lot of tactics.
Taktiikkaa pitää niinku käyttää.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The lead investigator begins questioning Hannu. During these interrogations, Hannu's responses suggest he knows details only the perpetrator would be aware of. In one session, the investigator plays a 1992 recording for Hannu. In it, when asked where he was when he realized that Raya was about to die, he responded, "By the safe, with a key in my hand." Suddenly, Hannu confesses to the murder. His eyes glaze, and he does something wholly unexpected. Hannu lunges at the investigator.
That kind of sudden attack against the investigator, who is trying to concentrate on the interrogation and writing it down, is immediately a dangerous situation. Hannu tries to hit my colleague on his face with a pen. He also used the board of the table. Luckily, my colleague was in good shape and he had quick reactivity and he was able to protect himself against the hits, so the physical injuries remain mild.
The struggle lasts about half a minute, during which the investigator primarily tries to protect himself. Eventually, he manages to shout for help through the door. The attack is investigated as an attempted murder. Ultimately, Hannu is convicted of assault and violent resistance to a public official, resulting in a 1.5-year prison sentence. After the attack, the lead investigator can no longer continue with the case. Nico receives an unexpected phone call.
I was on my summer holiday on a train traveling to the north. The previous lead investigator called me and told me I would need to finish investigating this case. So it was really significant for me, and still is when I look back at my career.
Nico doesn't rush to interviewing Hannu after taking over as the lead investigator. Instead, he takes his time, thoroughly processing everything. Since Hannu claimed he learned details of the case from magazines in the 80s and from watching the police TV broadcast, Nico dedicates days at the National Library. He combs through magazine archives to verify if they contain the specific details Hannu mentioned. Nico also obtains the old episode from police TV.
We checked certain magazines and police handouts through certain time periods, and when we compared them with the investigation secretary, we couldn't find any mentions about the modus operandi, which was really important because this is the information that the police protect, those details. Because if someone admits or knows details about the case, either the modus operandi or any other details of the crime, like the crime scene, it is really important that you don't inform the public the wrong way, too much. None of this information can leak outside of the investigation team. It can have a severe negative influence on the investigation.
In spring 2008, the detective inspector handling Raya Mukkonen's case receives a phone call. A crime journalist is on the line, informing the police that he plans to write an article about their investigation into the 20-year-old case and mentions that the perpetrator is currently in prison.
It is a juicy story for the journalist. 20-year-old cold case, a murder, and according to his knowledge, the police have the suspect. For us, this publicity does no good in this situation. When you think about the family of the victim, who don't know anything about the new investigation at this point, because until now, we didn't want to bring their hopes up. But when this journalist calls us, we decided we had to contact Raya's children.
Toimittajan puhelu tuli, niin päätettiin, että nyt yhteys lapsiin.
Nico contacts Raya's children, letting them know that the police have reopened their mother's murder investigation. On Tuesday, the 25th of March, 2008, a crime journalist, Hannes Markula, writes the story in the newspaper Ilta Sanomat.
The National Bureau of Investigation believes they have solved a brutal robbery murder. The crime took place up to 21 years ago in 1987 in Murala. The suspect is a man who is currently sitting in prison for other violent crimes. The victim was a 42-year-old financial manager who by chance happened to be at the scene. The National Bureau of Investigation doesn't want to give out the modus operandi. They also won't give out the identity of the suspect or in which prison he is at the moment. They are also silent about the suspect's age.
After the Ilta Sanomat article, Hannu wants to talk to the press himself. He contacts a crime magazine, Alibi, and says he can tell the real story about the killer. Alibi journalist meets Hannu Rissanen the 18th of April, 2008. Hannu says in the article, "This thing has oppressed me so much that I had to meet a psychiatrist twice. I think that the National Bureau investigation wants to create a Bodom investigation kind of situation." Rissanen claims he knows who killed Mukkonen. He agrees to tell this to Alibi, but not to the investigators. During the interview, Rissanen says he was in the same cell with the perpetrator, who there admitted the murder and told him details about the case. Rissanen said he heard how the murder was very brutal. There was a lot of violence because the victim's eyes were pierced, for example. "But I didn't do it," Rissanen emphasizes. Convenient for Hannu, the acclaimed perpetrator had died in 1994 and couldn't defend himself against the accusation. Nico diligently completes the report for the prosecutor. The introductory section alone spans 30 pages, demanding 3 weeks of his time. Yet, his dedication pays off. The prosecutor moves forward, taking the case to trial. The trial unfolds over a span of 3 weeks. Nico is present during the initial days, laying out the case. As proceedings advance, key figures, the prosecutors, court's chairman, jurors, police, and the accused make a visit to the crime scene, 21 years after the incident. Nico observes keenly. In court, Hannu sticks to the narrative he shared with Alibi magazine. He contends that he gleaned every detail about the crime from a former cellmate. The defense thus presents a theory. The fibers found on Raya's woolen shirt might match the ex-cellmate since they never aligned with Hannu's clothing. Perhaps, they argue, the ex-cellmate's DNA is present at the crime scene. To confirm the claim, the court orders the excavation of the ex-cellmate's grave. The DNA does not match. Furthermore, records confirm that Hannu and the deceased had never been imprisoned concurrently. In addition, the prosecutor enlists a criminal psychologist for profiling. After assessing the personalities of both men, she concludes that their crimes diverged significantly. The man who died in 1994 doesn't align with the profile of someone who'd commit such a heinous act. She also delves into various cultures, noting an absence of ritualistic murders exhibiting violence towards the eyes. Consequently, the court mandates a psychiatric evaluation for Hannu. After long evaluation, it is stated that Hannu was in a clear state of mind during the murder of Raya Mukkonen. He is evaluated as a dangerous person towards other people's health and life. Despite the lack of concrete technical evidence linking Hannu to the crime scene, he is sentenced to life imprisonment for Raya Mukkonen's murder. Nico Rantsi of the Criminal Bureau of Investigation states,
"When the accused knows enough and can tell enough about the details, in this case, in the questionings, that also can be enough for the verdict. If you can describe the crime with enough details, it doesn't need the technical evidence. Of course, that is a good addition for the case if that can be proved, but in this case, we couldn't get them."
The prosecutor states that in the murder there were signs of torture. The motive was robbery. In 2009, when the verdict came, this case was a record when it came to convicting a criminal for a cold case.
Se oli, mitä meidän tiedossa oli, niin kuin pisimpään selvittämättömänä ollut henkirikos.
For what we knew, this was the longest case that had been called before the verdict in that time in 2009.
Joka on niin kuin saatu tuomiolle.
The verdict is life in prison.
In our criminal law, there is a prison life sentence.
Matti Laine, principal lecturer.
It can be given also in some severe crimes against the state, like high treason, but this hasn't used actually after the Second World War. So all lifers, so prisoners who are serving life sentence, have been sentenced for murder.
At the outset, the defense contemplates appealing the verdict. However, Hanna retracts his appeal, stating he wants no further involvement with the case. He's sent to the Riihimäki prison, renowned as a facility for inmates deemed unsuitable for other penitentiaries. As one of Finland's most fortified establishments, it houses murderers, drug offenders, and gang members. In 2009, Riihimäki had the highest security measures in the country. For many, Riihimäki represents the final destination after failing to adapt to other institutions.
Riihimäki prison is one of the most secure closed prisons in Finland. It started early in 1930s. During that time, the inmates drained a swamp nearby. But nowadays, it has very good industrial metal workshops and also very developed vocational and general educational programs for prisoners. Of course, not all prisoners are participating in these programs. There are prisoners who are just staying in their cells, doing not much. And also in Riihimäki prison, there has been a special secure unit for dangerous prisoners. Very small one, only, let us say, maybe less than 10 persons serving their time there. And we must say that usually in prisons, also in Riihimäki, the prisoners who are serving life sentence are not always the most dangerous ones. Because in that unit, usually there are, for example, gang leaders, prisoners who are dangerous against other prisoners or to the personnel. And I think that maybe in most cases, the lifers, prisoners who serve their life sentence can serve their time at the end of their sentence in open prisons, which there are no walls or bars or something like that.
While incarcerated, Hanna partakes in an interview from behind bars. In 2014, Finnish journalist Arman Alisad visited him. Although the case is never directly addressed and the prisoner's identity remains concealed, it is evident that Alisad is conversing with Hanna. In this dialogue, Hanna recounts his tumultuous childhood marked by frequent parental disputes. Initiated into theft at an early age, he grew up within the religious framework of Jehovah's Witnesses. He's now estranged from his siblings, whom he once assaulted, a deed he feels justified in committing. From Hanna's perspective, since his youth, violence was the sole mechanism to resolve disputes. Memories of witnessing his father choking his mother still linger. He asserts that he never harbored any empathy towards his victims during his violent outbursts. Despite his refusal to admit to Raya's murder, Hanna believes his life's plethora of crimes justifies his lifetime incarceration. After a 13-year confinement, Hanna was released in May 2021, by which time he had adopted a new surname. The court determined he had sufficiently served his time. Despite being youthful during Raya's murder and middle-aged at his conviction, the Criminal Sanctions Agency expressed concerns about his persistently aggressive nature. However, the Finnish judicial system's decisions are rooted in long-standing principles.
Somebody might think that if we see that person is a dangerous one, he must be kept in prison all his life. But there is some philosophical problem. Can we punish a person for the crimes he maybe will do in the future? And the idea that this is not right comes from the 1700s. For example, one Italian philosopher of Enlightenment, Cesare Beccaria, wrote an important book at the end of 1700s, that this is not right, that you must be given a certain sentence, for example, 10 years in prison, not that you will be kept so that you will be not any more dangerous. So this is a difficult question because, of course, we know that there are people who can be dangerous after they've been freed from prison.
For over two decades, detectives relentlessly pursued leads in Raija Mukkonen's murder. Their unwavering dedication eventually brought justice for Raija and her grieving family, even if it spanned more than 20 years. While the Bodum case remains unsolved, Raija's case stands testament to the tenacity and reach of the justice system. Prior to Hannu's release, he had already spent 20 continuous years behind bars, accounting for his life sentence and prior convictions for other violent offenses. One can only speculate the challenges he faces reintegrating into society after such an extended institutionalization. Today, he goes by a different name.
This episode was written and reported by Marika Honkatukia. The script consultant was Ellie Salo. Producer and sound designer was Suvi Tuli Kataya. Narrated by Tova Valnay. Executive producer is Nils Bergman. The main source for this episode's material is from Niku Ransi's book about the work of an investigator. Nordic Crimes is a Tall Tale production. Please rate, review, and recommend the show to friends. Your support helps us reach listeners who might also appreciate the content. Thank you in advance.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional, unprofessional. So if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.